So yeah, there it was. We just heard that audio, and yeah, there's so much going on in this video that it's hard to know where to start. But for me, what sticks out the most is, he's in this like glittering skyscraper, fancy building, but in a public area like where people are allowed to be. And the police officer who approaches him is so, "Oh, hey, what are you doing here?" And she's like so typical Midwestern friendly, and then there's like the kind of, it's almost like farcical what happens. Like there's the good cop, bad cop thing. It's like classic. The other cop comes in, he's just like, "All right, you're going in." And she's like, "Well, just go in and just behave yourself." And I'm just like, "Wow, like really?" And then the people are just walking past. No one stops to ask, "Oh, what's going on here?" Even while he's screaming and crying,
My kids are there. I'm picking up my kids from the kindergarten. I have to go back to job. I have a job to maintain. He keeps pleading. I have a job to maintain. I'm not doing anything.
right.
And she's like, "Oh, you should have told me who you were." And that's the double standard, because I see endless videos of white people telling other white people, well, they don't exclusively say, address them to white people, but everyone who's non-white knows, I know this video will not help me not to talk to cops. You, as a person of color, you don't want to be shot. You will talk to cops, you will show them your ID, and you will just, because you know nobody will stand up for you. Nobody's going to protect you and defend you. Nobody stood up for me when I was attacked.
Right.
The cops actually came on the side of the students that attacked me and threatened to kill me and actually plotted to kill me and threatened me to give them good grades when I was teaching them. Okay, this is like unthinkable. But the videos go on to tell you have your rights. If you haven't been charged with anything, you don't have to talk to the police. You don't have to show them your ID unless you have been suspected. And he's just trying to exercise. He's like, "I was sitting in a public area. I have my kids. I have jobs. I'm working here. There are my kids." And they don't even let him. It's like all, it's a vengefulness because he is threatening the narrative of the resource that should submit.
I mean, just by being there, I mean, I remember we talked about this with Trayvon Martin also, him being in that sort of exclusive, gated community, and just his physical presence there said to trigger something within George Zimmerman, danger, danger, does not belong, and I feel like the security guard who accosted this person, let me see what his name is again, Chris Lally. Now, this all began with the security guard coming up to him and saying, "Hey, you can't sit here." And
And he
so,
just sat.
yeah, he said, "Well, what's the problem? I'm in a public area." But I'm thinking, of course, the security guard was most likely white. I mean, if the security guard was black, that's even worse. But it's like some internalized thing going on. But here he is, a guy. He has dreadlocks. He's black. Looking at it from the point of view that we've been discussing, it does make more sense. This creature does not belong in this expensive-looking complex with all of these well-educated people going to their, professional jobs. Maybe he wasn't dressed as professionally as some of these other people, but clearly, when people looked at him and when the cops came and looked at him, oh, it was just obvious. Like, this person is up to no good. They're trouble. They just don't belong here. It does not compute. This space is not for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and you never know. You want to make the place, the space sanitary and safe.
Right.
And then, of course, what is being not said, not articulated, what Pierre Bourdieu calls the doxa. It's the knowledge that everybody knows but does not need to articulate. And that's how it comes of itself. It acts of itself almost. Without us, almost like we only embody that self-evident knowledge that you do not belong here, because you are not part of that class, of that class of consumers. You are the resource. And he is a resource because he works there. So right. He did not come there to shop. He works there. His kids' kindergarten is there because he has to quickly pick them up and then go back to his job. But the narrative demands that he submit to that and reenact it. And so at first she's friendly, like, well, you know, I'm just trying to make it sure, and he's offended. And so to make it sure, then it has to become a public display. And then, of course, the minute it's a public display, this is the white supremacy schema, is that if anybody harasses a black person, the black person must have incited.
Right. Guilty.
Fear. Guilty.
Right.
Yeah, must have done something, because a normal, legitimate-looking white person would not be so irrational. And, you know, the white people, they, you know, they have this image of this angelic image, like the peace carriers, and like bombing the whole world.
Right.
Like a bunch, less than 20% of human population, and such ravaging. And still, they are the cherubby, you know, little naughty pranksters on, in a fresco in a church, you know, with golden locks.
And I mean, if I came across, or if anyone came across a white person being abused the way this person was in a public space, being forcibly taken to the ground and then tasered. I mean, so it's not like the police just kind of approached him and said, hey, you know, what's going on? They physically assaulted him, tasered him in front of his children, and you can see in the background of the video people just walking, like no one is stopping and gathering around and saying, oh, hey, what are you doing to that guy? What's going on? You don't even hear anything like that.
People, and he just wasn't resisting or anything. Actually, no. It's really good you bring that up, because exactly what I noticed when I was watching it is that they started tasering precisely when he said, these are my children. It's as if to show the children.
Right.
This is what's going to happen to you. Look at your dad.
Right. It reminds me of stories from World War II and other wars where soldiers would literally take women and rape them in front of the husband and do things in front of the men just to kind of shame them and show them, hey, look, we can just do whatever we want to you, and we're going to send a message to your children, to your wife or whatever, that you have no power here. And it's definitely a power thing that's going on in this video. Another related thing kind of connected to the response of the white people going past is a video that you posted a few days ago where this guy is talking about why more white people don't speak out against white supremacy. And this is also related to the article written by the woman who talks about why everyone's a racist and why people should just kind of like acknowledge that fact. Can we talk for a minute about what white people can or should be doing to confront racism? Because as the guy in the video says, white people who have confronted racism in the past are sort of swept out of history. Like, we don't really hear too many examples of white solidarity or white allyship or, like, white, what are people saying now, accomplices or whatever. Like, we don't really hear about that. So I think it is kind of a reinforced thing where people are taught that you don't get involved. You see someone being attacked by the police and they're not white, you know, either they deserved it or it's none of your business. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, so two things, because I would like to quickly go back to the point you make on soldiers raping women in front of their families and husbands, and actually, in my book on education, The Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams, I discuss this the rape and how it didn't even start as a race, but say, like, you know, the whole concept of slavery started with the need to have an agricultural socio-environmental paradigm, like a solidified socio-environmental economic paradigm that is based on the right to dominate the reproduction of resources. And so this is what civilized people need to address, that soldiers raping women, or the rape, the gang rapes that go on in schools, are not isolated, where the kids are treated as, well, you know, they did this problem, they didn't know there's bullying, we need to address the bullying, we need to address the gang rapes, the mass shootings. They are not isolated, and they are not, they are actually completely intertwined with the very root need of civilized order to reconfirm its hierarchy of who controls, and to remind the resources who controls the pleasure, and the, who controls the reproduction, and who controls the labor and the lives, and the and whether the resources will eat or die. Okay? And so that is totally and completely part of the structure, which makes it for the people who benefit and want to participate, want to continue to have their little prunes and raspberries and beefsteak, not to intervene and be punished. And this is what the video we'll go to the video now. What the white man in the video, and his name is Elijah Hamilton.
So I thought I'd do a little video about why most white people don't speak out against racism. This video was inspired by someone who I respect, who posted a Facebook status the other day. He said, how come all the other white people don't go so hard on the bad racist white people? You know, something comparable to how black people work hard to debate any of the bad black people who are simply frustrated with white racism and oppression. Why don't white people speak out against their own like we do? So I'm going to try to answer that to my best ability, mainly because motherfuckers go on the path of least resistance, you feel me? People tend to seek pleasure and avoid pain. That's like law number one. We do things that we're rewarded for, and we avoid things that we're punished for. And in order for white supremacy to survive, people who are for white supremacy are going to be rewarded. People who are against white supremacy are going to be punished. So for anyone who speaks in favor of white people, they get rewarded. For anyone who speaks out against white people, they get punished. And it doesn't matter what the race is of the person doing this talking. You know, it could be a white person speaking for or against white people, black person speaking for or against white people. Either way, the way you get treated depends on what your response is and what you're saying. Basic math. Take, for example, a black person who speaks out against black people. You know, this goes way back to slavery, those who lived in the house versus those who lived the field, whatnot. You know, nowadays it's usually black conservatives, quote unquote, they say, who will point the finger at other black folks and say, okay, you're the problem. You know what I'm saying? We're the problem. We're fucking up. That's why we're in the condition we're in. They shift the blame from white supremacy to a supposed black moral or cultural inferiority. And of course, white folks buy this shit. You know what I'm saying? They lap that shit up because it supports some of their ingrained racist beliefs. He helps them sleep at night. He either justifies their racist beliefs that they already had, or he helps them maintain their illusion that racism is over and that, you know, there are no racially based limits to your success in this world. And therefore, any failings you have on your part are based on your own failings, you know, not a system of oppression. He might get called a sellout or an Uncle Tom by other black people, but that doesn't really matter because they don't hold the power. You know, they're not the ones who can actually hold him accountable. It's usually going to be a white person who's signing his paycheck at the end of the day. It's a white person who decides whether he gets promoted or not, whether he even has a job or not, 9 times out of 10. A lot of these dudes even have careers just speaking out against other black folks. You know what I'm saying? Because white people will pull them out. Whenever, you know, something happens, they want to blame on white people. Well, pull out the black conservatives. All right, so that's one side of it. Other side is white people who speak for the interest and for the benefit of black folks and what happens with us. Most white people in this country either feel they have an interest in maintaining white supremacy or at minimum, you know, in not opposing it. Because when white people do take a stand, we get ostracized for it. And if you haven't seen that happen, it's probably just because white folks who speak out in the interest of black people rarely make it on TV. We don't get called in for the interviews. You know, sure, you got some white folks who will proclaim colorblind beliefs. You know, they say we're not racist on Martin Luther King Day. They all get around and sing Kumbaya, which is great. I'm not knocking that. But what I'm saying is, when it comes to actually challenging white supremacy in a real way or pointing out systemic injustices in this country, suddenly they're not around. Suddenly they don't want to speak about it. They opt out of the conversation. Most white folks, you know, or it, when they do go hard, they go hard on historical injustices. They go hard on slavery. They go hard on Jim Crow, you know what I'm saying, segregation. But they don't go hard on current systemic injustice. Only time they speak out against what's happening right now is when they're going against extremists, you know what I'm saying? Donald Sterling, they'll throw him under the bus. The KKK, neo-Nazis, skinheads, all that shit, they'll throw them under the bus. But all these people who subconsciously support white supremacy without even realizing it, they're left untouched. They always come to the defense, making excuses for them. And also, the media always portrays this whole thing as a black problem as well. You know, not taking into account the fact that the race problem in this country is actually a white problem. Because white people, for the most part, are holding the strings that actually keep the shit perpetuated. And anyone who identifies too closely with blacks, we get written off, you know what I'm saying, laughed at, looked out as clowns. They come up with words. Back in the day, it was, you know, N-word lover. You know, they call us wiggers, you know, all these different words they have to dismiss and shut down, basically, white folks who get too close to black folks. And it's funny because on one hand, you'll see the white saviorism mentality. You know, they got these movies coming out where it's all like the white people helping out the poor black people, you know, this paternalistic idea we have. But that's a fictionalized version. The actual white folks who really put themselves on the line and died for this shit, you never hear them mentioned. They don't talk about them in Black History Month. They don't talk about it when they're talking about the Civil Rights Movement. They don't talk about John Brown. You know what I'm saying? Hell, I can't even name most of the white activists from the past. And me being who I am, I should know. Most of us don't even know because it's hard. You gotta dig deep to find that shit. And I'll tell you why. It's because they don't want us to see that. They don't want us to identify with that. They don't want us to see that as an option for us. If we look at it like black folks stand up for black folks, white folks, all we have to do is just quote unquote not be racist, you know, and just go about living our lives in comfort. Well, this is what happened. Black folks get the impression that we don't care. They get the impression that white folks just don't give a fuck because of what they go through every day and what we continuously fail to acknowledge. Or even if we do acknowledge, we fail to do anything about it or speak out actively against it. And then white folks, because we don't see other white folks standing up for it, we get the impression that it's not our battle. We're not told the story that it's our battle. You know, and the cycle just keeps continuing and continuing on and on. Hell, I've even got people close to me, people who I know are not racist in their heart, who preach humanitarian values, all this shit. They've told me this is not my battle. Why are you fighting this? People I know and love. And when otherwise well-meaning white folks tell me that this isn't my fight, I ask you a question. Why the fuck isn't it yours? How about that? Think about that.
So what Elijah mentions is that white people who will see, well, all people who will threaten, but including who seriously threaten the order, will be disposed of, will be punished. At first, they will be reminded of the benefits they reap. And if they're stubborn enough and say, well, I don't want your benefits, I still think, you know, justice should prevail, they will be punished harder. And if still they have not learned, they will be disposed of. Just, you know, nobody wants to deal with revolutionaries, right?
Right.
And then, of course, history has to forget them. And because you don't want other people to know that there is, and this is what he said, we don't want, like, they don't want us to remember that there is another way. and that way might be, in the end, even if it costs us now, even if it's painful now, I mean, in the end, it is, he says, it is our white people's problem, and we need to address it.
Yeah, that was a powerful video. And what about this article with the girl who was talking about how she never viewed herself as a racist, but then she kind of came to the conclusion that she does hold these deep-seated attitudes and thoughts that she didn't really consciously realize that she had, but she kind of went through the process of examining some run-ins that she had with black people where she had this irrational fear come out of nowhere,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of led her to believe that, yes, she does have these racist attitudes, and that it's kind of something that all white people have being raised in the society. When you read her article and then look at it through kind of an anti-Civ perspective, do you think that she's going far enough in her analysis? I mean, is it really possible for white people to consciously take themselves out of a racist mentality or, like, purge themselves of these thoughts? I mean, is that really possible?
Well, it's good. It's always courageous to be honest
right.
about, you know, the flaws you suddenly discovered in yourself. My problem is that with an article like that is that it does not go far enough, in the sense that, again, you know, talking about the fear we have of black men, maybe then debating, oh, but I don't have fear, oh, but you have something else, oh, but maybe your racism shows. What is not being talked about is, you know, all of like the ideas and the attitudes and the fear itself would not matter if there was not a real unjust economic power that punishes, exploits, abuses people of color and non-human animals. Okay? And that's where it does not go, because it does not, in the end, it still focuses on this kind of the overt expressions of racism.
Right.
But what does it entail? Like, what does it entail for her? Like, now that she realizes she's afraid of black men.
Right. Okay. It's like, okay, that's great. Now what?
Now, exactly. Now what? Like, are you going to go and are you in a position of going and giving all the black men you're afraid of equal access to opportunities? No. Because civilization is based on that you will always be favored over, even with a criminal record, even full of drugs, even acting erratically. There was a case I saw recently where the white guy was like high on mushrooms, and he actually shot. But he was not killed. The police, he actually got out of his handcuffs, started bashing these police officers. Three of them couldn't contain him because he was like, oh, poor kid, like acting. Mm. And they got like a whole brigade come and subdue him and then take him and book him. On CBC 2 days ago on Canadian radio, they were discussing, there's anarchy in the title, but their use of anarchy in the show was very different. It's like, you know, rebels and their encounters with law. And you could definitely see some people, like they were interviewing different people, and you could see a black guy gets, like, it was funny, he was actually training, giving multicultural training to police officers. And then he was arrested by them because they thought he was suspicious. And it was like,
oh my gosh.
Exactly. And then an indigenous person, her brother drowned and nobody took it seriously, the police actually even kind of said, well, you know, stop looking for him. He probably couldn't stand you and ran away. And then turned out he fell in the river and died. And she was wondering, like, would they have saved him had they taken the family's concern? You know, and then you hear a white guy calls in and he's like, oh, you know, I had like this really funny, I was like so drunk and in public and I was running away and the warden was after me and I ran towards this, you know, RCMP, the, you know, the Alberta, the Canadian police mounties. And I ran into them and I tried to resist the arrest and then I gave up and they were all laughing. And I said, oh, kid.
Oh, my gosh. Know.
And then he got in jail and he hears this one guy is like, you know, for resisting arrest, he was like, you know, had to pay a lot of money, spent 3 months in jail or something, I don't remember. And he's like, oh, and I was slapped with a short, like a small fine, and I was told by the judge, oh, kid, you know, just, you know, don't drink again, ha, 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 and everyone is laughing.
Oh, my God. It's really disturbing. And, you know, I first started, your book really got me thinking about this a lot more, about what it means to be a human resource and why some people are favored more than others. And, when these shootings have been happening recently, I was thinking that, and also what you mentioned about, you know, white people being accosted by the police and having, like, a totally different interaction with them. And, like, mm-hmm. there's a case also of, like, a guy here in Philly or New York who's totally naked, you know, running down the street, hitting people and smashing things. And the police are, like, wrestling with him for about 5 minutes trying to subdue him. And they can't even subdue him because he's, like, slippery with sweat or something. And it's, like, almost comical.
A slimy bugger.
Right. And if he was black or brown, they would have just shot him. They wouldn't have bothered
exactly.
with all of that. And this is connected to the fact that I think, and I'm going to get your opinion on this, you know, white people being viewed maybe not consciously but subconsciously as taxpayers, as people who are going to be putting things into the economy, as people who are just, like, more productive, who belong here more than other people. And I remember reading about the situation in Canada right now with the with First Nations women disappearing. And Stephen Harper came out and said that they don't need it. That there's no need for an inquiry. There's no need for anything. I mean, it's just like a local police matter, even though all across the country of Canada, Native women are disappearing and being killed at, like, epidemic rates.
And it's really, and the hatred, that's like the hatred in the mainstream population is incredible towards Indigenous, well, First Nations people.
Right, and so, like, where, I mean, looking at the analysis that you use in your book, Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams, where does this kind of hierarchy of certain people being favored over others kind of come from, and, like, how can people start to, you know, effectively purge ourselves of viewing people this way? I mean, for those of us who are interested in actually confronting this system. I'm speaking more to, like, the white audience and people who are like, oh, wow, this is messed up, this is disgusting, and I really want to, like, try to do something about it. Like, what can people do, you know?
Going feral means that we refuse the punitive kind of the carrot and the stick system of domestication, which means that the whole idea that resources, human and non-human, have a right to exist if they serve the human being. And then, of course, we understand that the narrative then, this is like the main point, but then the doxa, or the unspoken self-evident knowledge, is that obviously not all human beings are human. So this differentiation begins with the domesticator, with the consumer of the world. I go deeper into this analysis even in the book that's coming out with Routledge on children's literature this December, finally, it's coming out.
Oh, great.
And so I go deeper into the roots of this narrative, because I am talking in that book specifically on how these narratives came about, how they get formed, constructed, and reproduced, and reinforced. Whereas in the Wild Children Domesticated Dreams, I really look at how the education system itself is a response to the needs of domestication. So it's more of kind of, I'm looking at how the training happens. How do we train human resources, the victims, and those who will, the consumers of these resources, the elites who have the right to control them, own them, and disown them, okay? And this is the whole point, that for people to understand their own stakes and how much actually they lose by even when they are in the consumer category, how much beauty you lose from a meaningful interaction with a diverse and viable environment, rather than an environment that is based on rape, because you need to reproduce by force, you need to breed resources, and through starvation and punishment, because you need to take away the livelihood from the resources in order to force them to comply with your needs. And then, of course, they have to always keep producing. It's a deficit-based economy. They always have to keep producing more, much more than what they will be allowed to partake from. And so this is the crux of the matter. The system itself starts from our accepting the narrative of predation and participating in a predatory food chain, socio-environmental paradigm. That means that even though the whole thing was kind of consolidated with the agricultural revolution, that kind of that brought with it new ways of dealing with the world, particularly with the living resources, plants, animals, animal people, human animals, you know, the whole gender kind of gets solidified, the difference, because then women are forced to reproduce the resources that are going to till the land, going to go to war, going to make the whole system work and function, going to punish. We need, you know, that's when police, the idea of needing police to dominate and make sure your society, you know, does not refuse, does not rebel, is born right then in a different form. It becomes more centralized later on with colonialism. So the idea itself, like what actually the problem is, what prompted this agricultural revolution and the new narratives and the new socio-environmental paradigm it brings. It's accepting a certain mutation of a certain group of humans towards carnivorism. So, and carnivorism meant that people started hunting, and when people started hunting, basing their group relationships on hunting meant that the women needed to gather much more to sustain the men who would then go and kill others. And again, an economic, socio-environmental paradigm based on deficit. And based on deficit means that you need to borrow from the future or from other sources of energy in order to maintain something that does not bring you enough energy. In a biodynamic environment where every species or every group of living beings contributes to the diversity and receives its mutualistic symbiotic system, and that is the most viable. The minute you start going into one group, starting an economy based on deficit, borrowing more and more, we are turning into a parasitic system where one group extracts much more than it gives back. And then it becomes unviable, and it becomes violent because you need to extract more, and the more you extract, the more difficult it is for the community of life around to rebound and to regenerate. And so monoculturalism that comes with agriculture and the narratives of violence become a response to that choice. And it's a choice. It's a cultural choice. We could choose to go a different way. This is the liberating part of my work, is that I do not say, oh, that's it, like mimetics, genetics, we're stuck. Oh, you know, that's it. We've come here. The world cannot be saved. We can change our narratives, our paradigms, our relationships, but it needs courage from the people who benefit the most to say, no, I will not be domesticated. I will not fear that life in the wilderness. Wilderness meaning that you are going to be engaged in diversity, in as environmentally viable, energetically viable system of relationships. I'm going to give as much to the world as it's going to, and I will tiptoe lightly not to crush anything, not to destroy anything, and to have other forms of life be a part of my world. Once we start, we liberate our thinking and our fear as thinking of ourselves as humans. And again, we're different. We're different, like Sister Soul just said, we're in different spaces. It requires much more to give up from white people than from the majority of people of color. I don't have anything to give up, so I'm free. I'm not embarrassed to say the truth because nothing holds me back.
All right.
But to come to that place takes perhaps much more courage for someone who really thinks they have a lot to lose. And this is the problem. And this is a problem that can be solved.
Well, you know what? I think that is the perfect place to kind of bring this to an end, because you said so succinctly what I think many other people have been trying to say for a while right now, regarding the situation that's happening not only here in this country, but, you know, all over the world. And the situation that we're facing with white supremacy kind of versus not just other people, but white supremacy against the entire system of life on this planet, and, you
exactly.
know, what it's going to take to bring that to an end. And I do know people in my own personal life who have that courage, and maybe they're not expressing it as much as they could, but I know that people can, I know that people want to, and I'm not saying that it's all up to them, but we can't do this without people, like you said, reaching deep mm-hmm. and kind of bringing that courage to the forefront, because, yeah, it's hard to give up your privilege. It's hard to say that, yeah, I've been given everything, and now I'm going to, like, throw it to the wind. I mean, I don't know what that's like, so I can't really imagine it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So not having been given everything on a silver platter, but I know that people can do it, you know?
I know.
I feel like a lot more optimistic now after hearing
and
you
diversity
say
of tactics. We should stop bickering and start really looking into scratching into the depths of our conscience.
Yeah.
The depth of our souls.
Face but didn't lose. wonder, steady going under. Was it the light waves so frightening? Was it a two wheels, one a mirror holding a steering wheel? Two wheels, one mirror holding the steering now.